I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Eliza Gaynor Minden, founder of Gaynor Minden, a company that designs pointe shoes for ballet dancers around the world. Eliza had been a dancer who recognized the pain and risk of injury that ballerinas experience firsthand, and she invented a more modern shoe to address these issues. Despite the controversy that Gaynor Mindens have aroused in the traditional ballet world, the shoes continue to gain acceptance among some principal dancers of leading dance companies. Eliza started the company with her husband, John, in 1993. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How old is the art of ballet?
Ballet evolved in royal palaces, really in the late Renaissance. And it traveled from Italy to France, thanks to Catherine de' Medici, who, when she married a French king, brought ballet du cour, which was court dancing, along with ice cream and artichokes, to the French court, where it really took root and flourished. That's why ballet terminology is in French still to this day. The steps and positions that dancers still practice every day were codified in the late 17th century. But we wouldn't recognize what they're doing as ballet the way we think of ballet today, because ballet today conjures up images of a ballerina in a tutu and toe shoes and a tiara sometimes. In those days, women had to wear great huge skirts, sometimes 6 feet in diameter, corsets, headdresses, wigs, often masks, little shoes with little slippers with heels on them. So it was, although some of the steps and positions are the same, it had a very different look and a different purpose. It was social dancing as much as performance dancing.
And when did toe shoes come into the ballet picture?
The hard toe shoe that we know today evolved at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century.
How did that evolve?
By the beginning of the 19th century, ballerinas, through their own strength and technique, were able to do a few things on the tips of their toes. They could not sustain long balances, they couldn't turn multiple pirouettes, but they could rise briefly and thrillingly onto tiptoe. And as it happened, this was the Romantic Age, and it was the same romanticism that informed poetry and music, informed ballet. And the stories of the Romantic era ballets are almost always an encounter between a supernatural female and a normal, more mortal human male. And so the ballerina's ability to rise up onto her toes played right into this because it made her look more supernatural, more ethereal. She's dainty, she hovers, she skims, she floats weightlessly. And her costume helped too because it was this diaphanous, billowy white tutu that looked very ghostly in gaslight, which also had come into being just around this time.
So in order to make the woman or the female look more ethereal and floating and blithe, the pointe shoes would help to create that effect to some degree.
What those Romantic era ballerinas did was reinforce their soft satin slippers, not the tip. And the look of it was very, very pointy. And if you look at those 19th century Romantic lithographs, it looks like she is balancing on an ice cream cone. The more reinforced pointe shoe that we know today that has a squarer block or toe box evolved at the end of the 19th century in Italy, and when those Italian ballerinas went to Russia, where ballet was flourishing under the czars, it was a huge sensation. Mm-hmm. And all the Russian ballerinas found that they, if they wanted to keep up, they had to get reinforced shoes too.
Now, toe shoes have remained pretty much unchanged in their construction and design since the late 19th century. Up through today, they're still made with paste and cardboard and paper. How come there has not been innovation in the toe shoe world until recently?
It's absolutely remarkable. I couldn't believe that I was the only one who saw this outrage and that it hadn't been corrected before. The people who know about the need, the dancers themselves, are one, very disciplined and not inclined to complain about pain or complain about their tools. Two, they're not paying for it. The dance companies or dancers' parents are paying for it. As I said, the pain and suffering part of it is kind of absorbed by ballet's tradition of hard work and discipline, and you have to suffer for your art. I think ballet is plenty hard without the unnecessary pain of pointe shoes, and that you will still suffer even if your shoes are comfortable.
Yeah, so I guess there's almost a rite of passage in the tradition, or a need to suffer for your art, as you say. In fact, on the cover of the Wall Street Journal, there was an article in which Suki Shorer, the teacher at the School of American Ballet, said that ballet isn't about health, it's an art form.
Well, with all respect to Ms. Shorer, you can't dance if you're not healthy. And ballet is extremely difficult, and there is a tremendous amount of work, and yes, some pain is going to go along with that work in order to become a dancer. But the unnecessary pain of pointe shoes was what really got me.
What part of this absence in toe shoe innovation came from the fact, do you think, that it's a women's sport or women's art? That if men wore toe shoes, do you think that there would have been more advances earlier?
Absolutely. I would not have my company if men had worn pointe shoes, because men, I think, are much more inclined to recognize a problem and complain about it and or fix it, whereas women don't so much, I think. Also, most dancers are not in the position I was in, which was having grown up in a household where there was discussion of manufacturing and injection molding machines and getting patents. That was part of my upbringing, was being in a family where my mother founded a ballet school. My father started a business.
Your father worked in the family business, which made light switches and electric wiring for lamps.
And I should also give credit where it's due to a liberal arts education, which teaches you how to learn what you need to know. As an English major, I didn't know anything about material sciences. And there I was a few years later studying plastics, which since the movie The Graduate had always been something that I never thought I would be interested in.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Eliza Gaynor Minden, founder of Gaynor Minden, a company that designs pointe shoes for ballet dancers around the world. Gaynor Minden pointe shoes are made with a synthetic plastic material that helps support the foot on point. Gaynor Mindens are made in the United States. You went to Yale University, but prior to going to Yale, you were a very serious dancer. You had danced throughout your childhood, so you experienced firsthand some of these issues with the pointe shoes.
Oh, yes. I was an ardent amateur, and I danced on pointe, and a lot of that experience was quite painful. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot it, and I never forgave it.
So fast forward, you graduate from Yale, and you end up working in managerial roles in some dance companies. What made you decide to start this pointe shoe company with a new innovative design? What was the catalyst for that?
I recognized the need, and I couldn't believe that nobody else had already done it. And I thought that if I didn't do it, somebody else would. And having worked in the management of dance companies, my resolve was strengthened because I not only had the pain and comfort reason to want to make a better pointe shoe, I had the economic one. I saw what a hardship it is for these dance companies to have to buy pointe shoes that last only one performance.
One of the first things you did was create a prototype. How did you go about creating the prototype?
In figuring out how to make a better pointe shoe, I bought every pointe shoe I possibly could and cut them all open on my brother's bandsaw to see how they were made. And it took about 3 seconds to decide that there was nothing more that could be done with these materials. So in order to make those internal components, I had to get a mold, eventually an injection mold, but first prototype molds. It was actually a funny coincidence. A friend of mine lived up in Maine and had a business providing parts for lobster traps for the lobstering industry. And he put me on to a fellow who put me on to a fellow who had worked in the shoe industry making lasts and molds. Unfortunately, it was in the mid-1980s when the shoe industry was going through hard times, and these guys were interested in working with me. And so they, together, we made the first molds and the first internal components. And then I took that and, in my own apartment, fitted it up with shock-absorbing foams, which I had gotten from the same companies that provide the athletic shoe industry with their foams. And so this soup ladle fitted up with the shock-absorbing foams, I then took to T.O. Day, a custom shoemaker, and asked them to please wrap it with pink satin, put an outer sole on it, and basically make it beautiful.
Now, T.O. Day is a shoemaker in New York City that does make special shoes. They've made Mike Tyson's boxing shoes and winter slippers for poodles in New York. And how many prototypes did you have before you came up with the shoe?
Dozens. It took 8 years. I had to do it one at a time, and not just one pair at a time, one shoe at a time, because it was expensive and I didn't want to blow it, you know, barking up the wrong tree. And then I put it on my own foot, and if I thought it was okay, I'd take it to my sister, and she'd put it on her foot. And if she thought it was okay, I took it to dance studios and flung myself at the mercy of dancers and said, "Would you please try this?" And, you know, some of them sort of wrinkled their nose and walked away. But most of them were very gracious and very generous and kind enough to try it out and say, "Well, you know, I'm too far forward, I'm too far back, this isn't comfortable here, it's too flexible in this place and too stiff in that place." And that was the process. that took me from one prototype to the next to the next.
It sounds like the Cinderella story of Prince Charming going around with this one shoe, having everybody try it on. I'm sure you got jokes about that all the time.
Absolutely. That's what it felt like, too. It was the quest.
Now, you mentioned you spent 8 years in research and development. Were you earning an income while you were figuring out all these prototypes during those 8 years?
Not much. I was working a little bit at the family business, and I taught high school students to do better on their SATs as a freelance tutor.
So when you were first starting the company, where were your offices?
In the very early days, we were selling them from our apartment, and we burst at the seams. Our hallway was so filled with boxes of shoes that we couldn't walk down it anymore, and so we realized we'd better get some more space.
What exactly is the distinction between the traditional toe shoe and the Gaynor Minden shoe, just to make sure that we have it clear?
On the outside, nothing. On the inside, everything. The internal components in a traditional shoe, and this is what provides support and enables a dancer to dance on her toes, are made of 19th century materials, leather, cardboard, burlap, fiberboard, sometimes even newspaper, held together with paste and sometimes little nails, which can dig into your foot. When the paste is dry, it's hard, and that's a lot of where the strength and the rigidity of the traditional point shoe comes from. But this breaks down over time and sometimes breaks down very quickly, often in as little as one performance. My solution was to make the internal components out of thermoplastic elastomeric, and that's a synthetic that is used in a lot of other applications, such as the curly part of a telephone cord or scuba fins. There are many different kinds of thermoplastic elastomeric, and it took a lot of work and a lot of prototypes to find exactly the right one and exactly the right grade of the right one.
So essentially this blah, 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 elastoplastomeric does not break. It's more durable.
Not only does it not break, it doesn't weaken.
You finally developed this malleable plastic that's like a telephone cord or a scuba fin rather than using cardboard and plastic. And this had created a lot of controversy. Did you expect that your shoe would produce this level of controversy in the ballet world?
No, I was very surprised by it.
What was the controversy? What would people say to you, especially in the early days, about the shoe?
Well, in many cases, they were just skeptical. And I can certainly understand that. They do feel a little different, and there can often be a period of adjustment in getting used to working in a shoe that feels a little different. For some dancers, it's only one class. For others, it's a couple of weeks. But the fact that for some people they feel a little different, that can be off-putting. And again, a professional dancer has probably, after 10 years, finally decided what her shoe is, and she's happy with it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Eliza Minden, founder of the point shoe company, Gaynor Minden. We'll hear more from Eliza coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Eliza Gaynor Minden, founder of Gaynor Minden, a company that designs point shoes for ballet dancers around the world. Eliza had been a dancer who recognized the pain and risk of injury that ballerinas experience firsthand, and she invented a more modern shoe to address these issues. Some people won't even say the word Gaynor Minden in the ballet world because it's so controversial, even though it seems like, oh, yeah, makes perfect sense. The shoe's much more comfortable. It lasts longer. Is there a difference in just looking at the two shoes? Does your shoe look a little clunkier or bigger than the more traditional shoe that might have caused people to shy away from it initially?
Well, fortunately, people are saying Gaynor Minden now. I think that the number of professional dancers and teachers who are endorsing them is going to dispel that. But to answer your question, in a studio, a trained eye can see the difference. Mm. From the audience, no.
Were there some issues with your shoes in the early days that needed improvement, that kind of was fuel or good juice for the competitors' claims?
Our first offerings were hard and harder. Mm-hmm. We didn't make particularly flexible, pliable styles when we first started. Mm-hmm. And I wish we had, mm-hmm. Because Gaynor Minden's don't break down, dancers would buy our harder shoes expecting them to break down as traditional ones did, and they didn't, and so dancers were disappointed and frustrated. Mm. So that was sort of a black eye in the early years that, oh, Gaynor Minden's are too stiff. So we immediately, as soon as I became aware of it, we started offering more pliable ones, and that went a long way towards solving the problem. But it opened up a new problem, which is that dancers are accustomed to a point shoe being stiff when it's new and breaking it in. And so when they try on a pointe shoe that's brand new and it's soft and pliable, they think, oh, well, this won't last. This will be dead in 20 minutes. And we had to say, no, trust us. It's not going to change. It's not going to weaken. And because that was so completely foreign to their experience, they really had to make a leap of faith to trust us and do that. And for years, I was annoyed with them for not trusting us until I went to buy a new windsurfer. I'd had a windsurfer for 14 years. And in those 14 years, the equipment and the gear had changed enormously. And all of a sudden, the new windsurfers were very light. And the man who was selling me the windsurfer said, now, what size sail do you want for this? And he suggested something very, very big. And I said, are you crazy? I'll never be able to manage that. I need the smaller size sail. And he said, no. You don't understand. The equipment's changed. It's lighter. And I didn't believe him. And I had one of those light bulb moments of empathy with my customers. So yeah. I met him halfway.
Luckily, you had started this company with your husband. So there's a lot of support, certainly, for the shoe at home. How did your husband come about starting this company with you?
My husband's background is in marketing and advertising. So after the shoe was designed and developed and patented and ready to make its entrance, John decided that he wanted to run his own business, and he was tired of the marketing and advertising world and wanted to have his own product. So we teamed up, and it's been a wonderful partnership and collaboration.
How does your professional life together inform your personal life? Because I would have to think that they overlap enormously.
We do talk about business at home.
Yeah.
In fact, we never don't think or talk about business. There are advantages and disadvantages of that. We try to carve out time when we just go off and do things that are not business related.
And one of the things you do that's not business related is you're both karate black belts. Is that correct? You're both black belts?
Yes, although my husband outranks me, so I have to bow to him, which is very irksome.
Do you and he ever do karate together against each other?
We do, and sometimes the instructors seem to think it's very amusing to line us up opposite each other. I like to think I'm pretty tough and fearless, but when I spar with my husband, it freaks me out, and I just can't take it. And I've heard other couples say the same thing, too, that even though it's playing and it's respectful and it's totally safe, there's something about hitting your mate that's very hard.
Yeah, wow. Even if sometimes intellectually you feel like hitting your mate, you just physically I'm just kidding. Why karate? How did that come into the picture?
John had started karate a couple of years before. And about that time, I was starting to go out on the road doing sales trips. I was going to all these cities where the downtowns empty out after dark, schlepping these great big sample cases of shoes, assisted by my very dainty 21-year-old ballerina assistant. And I thought, boy, we look like targets. So I'd better learn some basic street self-defense, just some stun and run stuff. And the Karate Dojo, which is Sado Karate, offered such a course. And as I did that, I observed the karate students doing the traditional Japanese karate, and I was intrigued by it. And I thought that these movements are very beautiful, very dance-like, and my ballet background actually served me very well in transitioning to karate.
Equipped with your karate prowess or expertise, you decide to hit the road and go to customers one at a time to try to gain adoption for your shoes. Tell me about that process, hitting the ground.
Well, we would arrange trips that would allow us to visit a number of cities and rent a car and drive around to stores, schools, and companies in that area. And we'd present our shoes and let them try on samples and just try to get the word out. We also went to summer programs. And what we did was made a presentation about ballet history, which allowed me to talk about my favorite subject. And that was a genuine educational service. It was not a sales pitch. And then the students were free to leave, or they could stick around and hear the sales pitch about Gaynor Minden. And then they were still free to leave, or they could stay even longer and try on some samples.
You also targeted younger dancers rather than, you know, the principal dancers at first because you wanted kind of early adoption. Pointe shoes are the type of shoes where if somebody makes their decision about what shoe they want early on, chances are they're going to stay with it throughout their dancing life rather than switch later on.
Exactly. They set their pointe shoe preference usually in the late teens.
Did you ever feel like Willie Loman, you know, Death of a Salesman, carrying around his satchel, going door to door? I mean, was there anything about that process that was depressing for you?
Oh, sure. You know, no one likes to be rejected. And yeah, but I just knew I was right.
Yeah.
And I knew that eventually other people would agree with me. And so far, I've been proven correct in that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Eliza Minden, founder of Gaynor Minden, a company that designs pointe shoes made of modern synthetic materials. Eliza is also the author of a book called The Ballet Companion. Now, was there one or two customers that opened the floodgates for you in terms of acceptance as a company? It's one thing for, you know, students in these ballet schools to adopt Gaynor Minden shoes, but how about a principal dancer?
Definitely. And one of the things you mentioned before about going to dance companies, we would be invited into dance companies with open arms by the dance company management because of the money savings that Gaynor Minden offered. But the dancers, in addition to being skeptical or not feeling any need to try something new, often resented management imposing the Econo shoe on them.
Mm.
And so we found that made it even harder to get professional dancers to try us. So we focused our efforts on students, as you mentioned, and that has now paid off as these students who adopted Gaynor Minden as teenagers are now becoming big stars in big companies. And one of them, and this was very important for us, was Jillian Murphy, who was a principal dancer at American Ballet Theatre. She discovered Gaynor Minden's in North Carolina when she was studying at the North Carolina School of the Arts. So Jillian came to ABT with her Gaynor Minden's, and people noticed what she was wearing, and she also rocketed to the top of the company in record time. So having her dance so beautifully in the shoes made the case more eloquently than any ad I could have devised.
And lucky you, the New York Times wrote that Jillian's feet were as strong as a truncheon, yet sensitive as a finger.
That was a lovely comment. It was actually in the New Yorker.
Okay. So that was kind of a turning point for you in terms of acceptance.
That gave us huge credibility. And we'd spent so much time and effort talking about the common sense virtues of the shoe. It lasts longer, it's more comfortable, it's quieter, we're trying to prevent injury. And those arguments really fell on deaf ears. It was only when a beautiful dancer did beautiful things in Gaynor Minden's that the dance world took notice.
Now, some of your competitors are Frieds of London and Capizio, of course, which is such a presence in New York. Have they adopted new materials into their shoes as a response to Gaynor Minden's shoes?
Sometimes we see some of our competitors doing things that we've already done, both in the construction of the shoe and also in advertising it. In general, though, not so much because, one, Gaynor Minden's are patented, and two, for the makers of traditional shoes to start doing what we're doing would be for them to say that we're right.
I want to talk about the economics of the pointe shoes. How much do traditional shoes cost, roughly?
Between $50 and $100.
And how about Gaynor Minden's?
$75.
No, Gaynor Minden's claim to last 3 to 5 times longer. So after one performance, you're not done with them. You could wear them for a few more performances. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Now, how many shoes does a dancer in a leading ballet company go through in a year, would you say, roughly?
It can be as many as 10 pairs per woman per week. A big company can easily spend $500,000 on pointe shoes alone.
Interesting. And how many sizes do you offer?
2,951 possible size and style combinations. Learning how to manage our inventory was a big part of our learning how to run our business. And that big number comes because it's not just length and width.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the box, whether it's a narrow and tapered box or a big wide square box. It's which shank it is. And we make 5 different stiffnesses. We also give dancers a choice of vamp, which is the part of the shoe that covers the toes and the top of the foot, and a choice of heel. So you do the multiplication, and it's 2,951.
Well, whereas in sneakers, do you pronate or don't you pronate? Talk to me about foot architecture. If you have perfect feet in the ballet world, what does that mean to have a perfect foot?
Aesthetically, the highly arched foot is prized, because it finishes the line of the leg in a very beautiful way. It's not always the strongest foot, so it's a mixed blessing for a dancer who has that kind of foot. The less highly arched foot is often stronger and can do more virtuosic things on point more easily.
And there are some terms like, what is peasant foot or Giselle foot? this is a whole world that's new to me. So what is a peasant foot look like?
The Giselle foot is wide and meaty. It's a good sturdy foot. And when you squeeze...
Like a good burger?
Well, less compressible. When you squeeze the gazelle foot, when you squeeze the metatarsals close, you know, in towards each other, they don't move much because it's pretty dense. And that's important in pointe shoe fitting because the other kind of foot, the fine-boned compressible foot, the foot is narrower and it can drop more easily in the toe box. It can slide around. That puts more weight on the tip of the big toe and that can be painful.
And how about a peasant foot?
Same thing.
Same thing.
We thought Giselle's a more refined way of saying peasant foot.
How come men don't wear toe shoes? Do you think men will ever wear toe shoes?
Well, they do when they're en travesti, when they're dancing female roles, and that's usually done to great comic effect, or for very special roles like the donkey in Midsummer Night's Dream, who uses pointe shoes as hooves. It is part of the ballerina's look and line. It elongates her leg. It gives her that ethereal, weightless, gravity-defying quality that is so feminine. I wouldn't be surprised if there's experimentation. And we actually do sell quite a lot of shoes to the Ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo, which is the hilarious all-male troupe that does ballet parody. But there's not been a lot of new choreography or serious choreography for men on point. Mm. I'd love to see it, of course.
I'd like to talk about eating disorders for a moment because they're kind of rampant in the dance and ballet world to some extent. Did you experience some of those issues firsthand when you were growing up with other people in your class?
Oh, yeah. In the 1970s especially, there was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't talked about and people didn't know how to get help. And it was a problem. Fortunately, the dance world has really acknowledge this and is taking steps to address it.
Like what?
And, well, Gaynor Minden actually ran an Eat Right advertising campaign. There's a field of dance medicine now that really didn't used to exist to address dancers' injuries and also nutrition and healthy eating. Many dance schools now bring in medical people to talk to the dancers about the importance of proper eating habits.
But I think where it's most well manifested is when a dance company brings in a dancer who's not stick thin. I mean, that's really the way that you're going to break this mold in the dance world is by bringing in and accepting people who are a normal weight and not solely accepting into these dance companies these very waif-like dancers.
Yes, there's been progress in that. There are a lot of wonderful dancers, leading dancers, who have womanly curves, and they're beautiful. And they can still do everything that the sylphs can do.
And why do you say the 1970s specifically?
The 1970s was sort of the age of cigarettes and tab as the dancers' main sources of nutrition. And today's dancers are much more health conscious, really much more. They eat healthy, clean food, and they rarely smoke. They're much more aware of themselves as athletes and of maintaining their bodies that way. And that actually has been very good for Gaynor Minden because our whole approach has been you're an athlete as well as an artist.
Here you are as a female pioneer changing a part of the dance world or changing a facet of the ballet world. Have there been other women who have taken similar progressive actions in some other way?
Well, this is one of the things I love about ballet history because so many of the milestones in ballet history happened because a woman, a strong-minded woman, did something or didn't do something that changed ballet. There's a real feminist trajectory in the history of ballet.
What's an example of that?
Well, the first thing was for women to perform on stage at all. There was a time when the church denied rights to performers. It was especially unsuitable for a woman to perform. So that first woman who went out and danced on upstage in a public theater was very brave.
Interestingly, because I think of ballet as being like traditional and not necessarily progressive in that manner. What's another example?
Scandals and skirmishes over costumes and modesty have been a recurring theme. Abandoning masks so that dancers could use their face and be more natural was one change. Getting rid of corsets so that they could move their upper bodies more freely and breathe more easily was another. Letting their hair down again to be more natural was considered shocking. Raising the hemline above the ankle was shocking. That was done first by Marie Camargo, who was a very virtuosic, very brilliant dancer, and she had mastered some steps that were men's steps in which the legs beat in the air in a very brilliant, flashy way. But it was for nothing if her feet couldn't be seen underneath a floor-length skirt, so she shortened her skirts. And it was a scandal and a huge success. And then, of course, in the 19th century, when the ballerina rose on point, all of a sudden, for the first time, the female dancer was more important than the male dancer. She is the preeminent one. And in fact, some of those 19th century ballerinas enjoyed rock star status. Marie Taglioni, for example, who was the first one to dance a full-length ballet on point, who was really the pioneer of point and who changed it from being a sort of a stunt or a circus trick into a genuine means of artistic expression, was hugely popular. There's a story that when she was traveling in some dark night in the woods, her carriage was seized upon by bandits, and they were going to rob them. But when they found out that the carriage contained the great Taglioni, they said, "We won't rob you if you'll just dance a little bit for us."
Aww.
She obliged. There's also a story that her fans in Russia were so thrilled by her performance that they cooked her shoes and ate them with a sauce.
Now, how do you have such a vast knowledge of the ballet world? You're a walking encyclopedia when it comes to ballet. How has that developed throughout your life?
I love it. And I was very lucky to have a mother who loves ballet. And in the 1970s, she took me to New York to see the Joffrey and American Ballet Theater all the time. When I was in school, I used every opportunity I could to write about dance and dance history for my academic schoolwork.
Now, this is while you were at Yale.
And before. And I took a U.S. history assignment and turned it into a report on Ted Shawn, the founder of Jacob's Pillow. And
a dance festival in the Berkshires in Massachusetts.
And at Yale, an assignment for a philosophy course having to do with presenting an argument. My argument was the dance department at Yale needs a lot of improvement, that dance at Yale is not being treated as well as music and theater, and that we deserve better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Eliza Minden, co-founder of Gaynor Minden. Coming up, we'll meet Simon Pierce, the glass blower and founder of the glass company Simon Pierce. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass, furniture, and pottery for the home. Simon is a hands-on craftsman who started selling his glass in rural Ireland in the 1960s. Even today, he generates his own electricity, builds his own furnaces, and makes all of his glass by hand. Simon Pierce has an international presence, including 12 retail stores in San Francisco and on the East Coast of the United States. Simon, can you please describe your business and tell me how your interest in glass originated?
Well, the emphasis on things to use on the table. And it all started, it started with pottery because my father was a potter and he made functional pottery. I did pottery for a number of years and then I switched to glass because nobody was making glass of the kind that I really liked, which had the same character as the pottery, which had a handmade feeling, like the early English rummers and the French rummers of 150 years ago. I used to buy them in junk shops for 50 cents in those days. They've now become sort of collector's pieces, and they're more expensive, but they had a very simple, a beautiful simplicity about them, a real feeling of handmade, which I really liked. And so that's how I got into the glass business.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in County Cork, in the southeast of Ireland. My father moved there when I was 4 years old. And contrary to what everyone believes, I'm not Irish. I actually have no Irish blood. My mother was Welsh and my father was English, and I was born in London. But we moved there when I was four, and Ireland's the country that feels like my home. My father was actually a very interesting man because his father started a printing works in London, but he really didn't want to live in London. And he discovered this little village. The story goes, he got the ferry to Cork and he had his bicycle with him and he rode it down 20 miles to this village called Shanagarry and stayed with some friends he'd been given the name of. And he was meant to stay for afternoon tea and he stayed for the rest of his life.
He seems to have had an adventurous spirit, just getting off the ferry and taking his bike and deciding he wanted to live there. Do you feel like you have some of that adventurous spirit in you?
Yeah, I probably have too much of it in me. It's interesting now you say that, where it comes from, but we definitely had that adventurous spirit. And I was very dyslexic, which nobody knew at that time in Ireland. And I really was never meant to be at school. It just didn't work. You know, school and I just didn't agree. And I'd keep running away and they'd keep sending me back. And it's actually an interesting story. I kept saying to my parents, I want to leave school. And they said, well, you can't leave school. You know, you have to go to school. And I kept doing, every summer I'd say, I want to leave school. And finally they said, okay. And I was 15 and, you know, I was halfway through high school. And I thought, wow, that was easy. You know, that's amazing. I hadn't really expected them to say yes, but they did. And I spent a year at home working in the pottery. And then I went off to New Zealand to learn to make pottery when I was 16. When I came home a few years later, when I was 21, I was sitting opposite my father at a dinner party. And I overheard him say to the person beside him, when Simon was expelled from school, and I had never known till that moment that I actually had been expelled. They hadn't just let me leave. They'd had to let me leave, wow. But they'd never told me.
What a sign of your parents trying to instill a sense of confidence in their dyslexic son. They were followers of this educator named A.S. Neal, who advocated a form of education allowing your children to do anything they wanted. Can you explain that a little more?
He basically believed in the child and believed that the children who were having problems or in trouble just weren't really being helped find their path. And so in his school, you didn't have to go to school. You literally never had to go to a class at Summerhill. And he found that the kids, he really wanted to go to school, but if you forced them and if you made them, it didn't work. And they pretty much ran the school. They made all the rules. They decided, you know, how people should be punished or if they should and when. And it was a very extraordinary place.
And how did that manifest itself as a child? Are there any anecdotes that you can recall?
Yeah, my parents basically brought us up like that. We had an extraordinary level of freedom, always. They believed in letting the child find the limits. In other words, they never said, don't touch, don't do that, don't go there. There was virtually no don'ts. One day I wanted to go up to the chimney. And I was, I think, 8 years old. And there was quite a steep slate roof. My mother couldn't bear to watch me do this, but she couldn't stop me either. She didn't want to stop me. So she got in the car and left while I climbed out the skylight and climbed up onto the top of the roof and looked out, you know, over the bay or whatever I wanted to do and came down. But that was the degree to which they believed that we should find our own limits and barriers. To me, that seemed absolutely normal. And today here in this country, you'd probably be arrested, you know.
Child negligence.
Child negligence or something.
Have you translated that philosophy onto your own family?
I would say we had very much the same parenting skill. We did it the same way. I think we toned it down a bit, so our life as parents was not quite as crazy as my parents.
Or as miserable, perhaps?
Or as miserable. I mean, they had some tough times with us because it's not an easy philosophy to execute.
What I also found interesting about your parents was not only instilling the sense of self-confidence mm-hmm. and adventure, but they also placed an emphasis on the products that you used in their mm-hmm. in your home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was really what their sort of life centered around was, I think, beautiful objects and beautiful things. And music. My father he loved classical music and books because he had an antiquarian bookstore at one point. But they had this sort of philosophy that everything you used should be thought about. In other words, you didn't just buy something without taking some trouble to look at it and make sure that it was something you really wanted and really liked and that was really beautiful. And that didn't mean the things were expensive. I mean, I'm talking about things like egg cups, every little detail.
In a way, that whole emphasis portended or foreshadowed your interest in pottery and glass. Was it more through osmosis, or did you sort of have an epiphany moment where you said, I want to be a potter and a glass blower, and I want to make a business of this?
No, it was much more through osmosis. I always knew I'd do something with my hands. That I don't know why, but from a very early age, I knew that I would work with my hands. And I think at that age, I wanted to try something different and different than what my father had done. And that was at that same time I started collecting that early glass that I liked so much. So that's how the two kind of came along.
My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass furniture and pottery for the home. How do you then turn this interest in glass into a business?
It was very hard to get into the business. I wrote to 15 companies in Europe, and most of them never applied, and the ones that did said no. Glass was just beginning in Europe in those days, studio glass. There was only one school in England called the Royal College of Art that had a glass department. And it turned out that a friend of ours was on the board of the Royal College, and she introduced me to the professor who ran it. And my belief had been if I was went to a college, you know, I'd never learn the skill. But it was the only option I had. And the professor at the time said he'd take me on for a year. And I was right. If I'd been there for 50 years, I never would have learned to blow glass. But it acted as a great stepping stone, you know, and I've always been very grateful to him for giving me that opportunity to at least get in somewhere. So then I went to the Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam. And then one of the professors there said, well, you should go down to Leerdam, which is a famous glass factory. And that's where I discovered the secret of getting into glass factories. You just go and you arrive and you talk to the foreman, not the top people who run it. That was where I got my first reel in. And I worked in that factory for 3 months with their master glassmaker as his assistant, just his gopher. And then I went down to Venice and got into a glass factory there called Vanini, which is one of the famous Italian factories, and worked there for 3 months. And my job there was at about 6 in the morning when they started. I would go out to the local store and buy liters of white wine and liters of Coca-Cola and mix them 50-50. That's what they would drink from 6 o'clock in the morning until they staggered out of there at about 2 in the afternoon.
What is one called, that concoction?
Well, it doesn't have a name that I know of, but it was great for the thirst, and it kept everyone happy. And they were the most skillful glassmakers I've ever seen anywhere. They were making the most incredibly elaborate pieces, unbelievable.
So how old were you during all this time? Were you in your teens?
I was about 19 when I was in doing that.
So then at what point do you say, okay, I'm ready, I have enough experience and expertise, I'm going to go back home to Ireland and open up my own shop?
Well, it had been 2 years since the time I started at the Royal College and I finished in Scandinavia. So it was 2 years. I got my inheritance from my father, which was $10,000. The Irish government gave me some help, and they had a small business loan, which I got from them. And so I put it all together and built this factory. West factory was a small workshop, really. I was interested in making functional glass, simple, beautiful, functional glass for everyday use. I wasn't interested in making art glass, one-of-a-kind pieces. But an interesting antidote, on my way back from Europe, I'd made a whole lot of samples of the sort of glass I wanted to make. And they were pretty basic and crude and so on, but I was very proud of them and I thought they were beautiful. And I went to London and I went to see the buyer at the General Trading Company and Liberty's, and I think it was Harrods was the other one, you know, and I proudly showed them my ware and said, you know, and they said, oh no, our customers would never be interested in something as basic or as crude as that, you know, that we'd never have a market for that. So that kind of deflated me a little bit. But I went back to Ireland and set up my workshop because I still believed, and I had enough friends who I knew were giving me honest feedback. The interesting thing about that is within 5 years, once I got going and we got a lot of publicity because I think that it was so unusual what we were doing in the very early days. All three stores came back looking for the product and never having realized that I had visited them or they had been turned me down. You know, there was that sort of disconnect. Once you've been written about and there's something, people think there's something special about what you're doing, then people change. It's amazing how that happened. But so I was trying to do, as everybody does when they start their first small business, everything. And I blew glass every day, but I'd be up all night with the furnaces trying to get the glass to melt. And I was also trying to run the business. I mean, trying to get the orders and trying to sell the product. And
how were you at the business? Because you had focused so much on the craft side of things. Did you like the business component, or did your father instill some sort of business acumen in you?
One of the things that I felt was really special about him was that he really enjoyed both parts of the business. He really enjoyed making pottery and all aspects of the making. And he also really enjoyed the business. He really enjoyed keeping his books, even though there was kind of one little ledger, but he really enjoyed that. And he really enjoyed dealing with the customers, and he really enjoyed selling the product. He had incredibly good business principles, like he was never late with an order. If you ordered something and he said you'll have it in 3 weeks, you had it in 3 weeks. And so I observed those growing up, and it was a great, great advantage, because I think many craftspeople would have a much easier life if they enjoyed the business side. But there's kind of this thing that we craftspeople can pick up, which is that the business is kind of a dirty word, you know. If you're into making things, beautiful things, then the business and making things don't really go together. But in fact, once you make something and sell it, you're in business. Whether you like it or not, you're in business.
Luckily, you did enjoy both sides, the craft and the business. How does your business then end up on the other side of the Atlantic in New England?
I was getting frustrated running the business in Ireland. There was a lot of things in those days that made it very difficult. And a lot of the basic services didn't work very well, like the phone and the post office and the taxes. So I just was getting very frustrated. It was after 10 years and the business was finally beginning to work financially. It took about 8 years for it to break even, and I decided to move to America.
And why did America appeal to you as a place to open up your business?
Because all my dealings with Americans, and we'd exported quite a bit of glass, and I say to small accounts, small amounts, but quite a few around the country, and all my dealings with Americans had been incredibly straightforward, and they did business, it seemed, the way I liked doing business, which was, you know, you just do what you say you're going to do and you get on with it. And I love New England. I love Vermont. And I love the feeling of the country up there. And
were there things that were more difficult than you had expected initially?
Yes, there were. The only thing that was really threw me for a loop was the cost of doing business. And that was a real struggle. The things we didn't really have to do in Ireland, or didn't cost much if you did do them, like use lawyers and have insurance. All those sort of basic things that people use a lot of in this country and you have to use in business here, and health insurance and all those, we didn't have those.
And where did you set up shop in Vermont when you came?
We found this extraordinary woolen mill. It's an old brick woolen mill on a river in Vermont in a village called Queechy. And it's absolutely a spectacular sight. And the moment I saw it, I fell in love with it. I had a strong sense that Queechy would work, looking at the map and where it is in relationship to Boston and the major highways and all the tourists that come up for the summers and fall and so on. And it was just an extraordinarily beautiful sight.
It is. I've been. And what are your total sales?
Total sales are about 30 million.
And when you first came to the United States, which was when? In
1971.
What were your sales once you got the mill off the ground?
I can't remember exactly, but I think we probably did about 100,000. You know, I can remember it took us about 5 years to break a million. And I thought that was, you know, the moon. I never in my wildest dreams thought we would do $1 million in sales. Well, no, not quite. It doesn't work like that. I always remember when the Irish Times wrote an article about me after we'd set up here, and they talked about the Irish millionaire. And I said, well, only in Ireland would they call somebody a millionaire who owes $1 million. It was a bit of everything, and it was that the retail store in Queechy was really the bedrock of the whole business. I wanted to make it a destination, almost an educational destination, where people could really come and see the product being made and use it, eat off it in the restaurant, drink out of it. So we had a glass making, we had the pottery, and we had the restaurant, and we had the retail store, where people could not only see it but touch it. I always have a hard time with parents who tell their children not to touch the glass, because I love the children to touch the glass. And the children never break the glass. It's the parents who break all the glass. Mm. You know, they knock it off with their handbags or so on. But so
you should have a sign saying, children, please touch.
Yeah, we should have a sign saying that. Because to me, and that goes back to my mother and the education where, you know, the message you send to the child when you tell them not to touch, I think, is a really, really negative message. Because you're really telling the child it's not smart enough to pick this glass up without breaking it. And I think that it's a very, very strong message if from the time the child is born until it's an adult, it's being told, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, because you're not smart enough to pick it up without breaking it, which is... So, anyway, I shouldn't go off on my educational things.
Well, no, for those parents listening, I think they might want a lesson or two from Simon Pierce. Incidentally, you have a purple, it looks like a purple flower as your logo. What is that, that purple flower?
What that is, it's called a puntal mark. And when you make the glass and blow it, there's two ways to finish it. The way they used to finish it 100 years ago, which is you put a you attach it to another rod on the bottom, and you break the glass off the blowing iron, so it's now supported by this rod, which is called a puntal iron. It's a French word. And you heat up the rim in a little furnace called a glory hole, and you hand finish the rim. And that's how we finish most of our glass. And it also leaves this mark, which is our trademark, which is the puntal mark.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. It was a real pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Simon Pierce, the founder of Simon Pierce, a company that makes handmade pottery and glass for the home. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions or comments about the show or about an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.